When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
For her part, Lyra was a little surprised to find that the scholar she sought was female. But the alethiometer hadn't said a man, and this was a strange world after all. The woman was sitting at an engine that displayed figures and shapes on a small glass screen, in front of which all the letters of the alphabet had been laid out on grimy little blocks on an ivory tray. The scholar tapped one, and the screen became blank. "Who are you?" she said.
Hello and welcome to His Darker Materials, the podcast where we run through the BBC HBO show His Dark Materials, episode by episode. I'm here as always with Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
And today we are joined via virtual room by the wonderful Simone Kirby. Hello, Simone.
Hello.
And Simone, you play Dr. Mary Malone on the show, who we met in this episode.
Yes, I do.
Yes. As always, before we chat to Simone, spoiler warning for all of His Dark Materials that has aired to date. So that's everything in season one and season two. Episode 2. If you want to chat to us, you can do so at Stripped Media on Instagram or at Stripped Media UK on Twitter. And remember to use the hashtag HisDarkerMaterials, because that's us. So Simone, look, we ask this question of everybody who comes on the show, and hopefully it won't be a surprise, but what is your... Oh, your face. You look nervous now. What if you had a demon, what would it be?
I knew that I was going to get asked this. So I was having a good think over the last year. And I think it would be a robin.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, they're quite nosy little things. They seem friendly, but they're also quite protective of their patch. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I just like them. Yeah,
that's
they're quite
answer.
Bossy.
I sat on a bench recently, and it was the highlight of lockdown 2.0. A robin came and sat next to me for upwards of 40 minutes. I mean, I was on that bench for quite a while. And it was one of the absolute highlights of my year.
Oh, so I do love nice. Them.
It's not a very good story, but
they're in our garden, and we put up a tent during the summer. And Robin came straight down, came into the tent, looking around. You know, what's this? This is new. We were all just like, nobody move. I love them.
There's a kind of an innocent arrogance to robins.
There is, yeah. They're just like, I'm interested. I'm not scared. They're brave. They're brave because they're not scared. Yeah. They're just really nosy.
So, so Simone, what's your relationship to the books? Had you read them, you know, years ago? So you knew them pretty well when this came up.
I read them really early in my relationship with my husband when we were dating. We read them together. I think he may have already read the first one, and then I read the first one, and then we read the rest together. Not together with one book. We had our own books. Don't turn the page yet. And we were massive, massive, massive fans. And when anybody would say, what would your top five books be? They were always in there.
Oh, amazing.
So I was a huge fan,
Yeah. So did you hear about this and sort of go for it, or how did it come to you?
I don't know how I missed it, but I didn't even hear they were making a first season.
Oh, wow.
I knew nothing about it. And then Callin Crawford, the casting director, one of the two casting directors, I'd worked with her in a Ken Loach film about, six, 7 years ago. And I got an email to ask would I go on tape for Mary Malone and His Dark Materials, and I was really confused because I thought it was the first season, and I was thinking, I don't remember Mary Malone being in the first season. What's going on? And then I found out that they'd already made a season and this was the second one. And I don't know how I missed that. And yeah.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah.
How would you describe Mary Malone, or what sense did you get from her from the books? And then what did you kind of bring to her on the screen?
I love with her, she's so independent. She's also, I think, one of the most honest character in the books. What you see is what you get. While, you know, everybody else, there's a little bit of, you know, a darker hidden side. And while she's a complex person and she has her own past and she has her own private things, she's not carrying around a lot of angst like the others are. So I think as you follow her journey, I think the audience can relate to Mary quite easily because she feels, and I know with the writers, I think they felt like she was one of them and the writers of the series. And I love that about her. And I also love that you're talking about a woman who's around 40, isn't talking about, well, much about relationships or, you know, she's just doing her own thing and she's really involved in her work. And I just really like her. I think she's great.
And curious and engaged.
Very,
and just wants to know more about the world rather than, you know, not that there's anything wrong with being, you know, interested in husbands and babies and all the rest, but like she's got other priorities as well.
Totally. Yeah.
There's a confidence to Mary as well, isn't there? Like the self-assurance as well, I find that you certainly brought that.
Yeah, I think she's gone on such a journey in her life that she's become very accepting of herself and very comfortable in her skin. And she's not trying to prove herself as a person. She's so wrapped up in trying to find out what dark matter is that the other stuff has just sort of fallen away, and it makes her quite a simple, straightforward person.
Awesome. Okay, well, we'll get into the meat of the episode and we'll come back to Mary in a minute. But as always, we're going to go through plot by plot. So why don't we kick things off with, where we left things last week. So Will and the Spectre. Although we don't seem to, it seems to have escaped that one.
That's just, we were sort of left with this kind of, not cliffhanger, kind of spectre hanger. He was literally hanging over his head. And then that's gone, I guess. So I think we can...
Yeah. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully the conclusion is Will's still a bit too young and everything's fine and everybody's okay.
They were having a sniff.
Yeah. Just testing whether they wanted the main course or not.
Yeah. No, he's not 16 yet.
Now we don't get much Siddhi Gaza in this episode, but we do get some playful fun with Lyra. Preparing for sort of our world and going through a sort of fancy dress 80s style montage, which I enjoyed.
Interesting that Will doesn't appear to be a pop culture fan because he doesn't put on an Edna Mode voice when doing no capes. So he obviously hasn't seen The Incredibles, but he's right. You know, that would probably draw attention in Lyra's case. She seems to think he's a bit of a stick in the mud and no fun at all when he's, you know.
Yeah. I loved how Pan was encouraging her. Yeah. Like, oh, that looks fantastic.
this is Lyra's first experience of the alternate version of her Oxford. Mm. And it was, I found it really enjoyable and endearing to watch her enter this world, you know, from the getting almost knocked over by a car and then just like entering Oxford and how familiar it all seems to her, but different and the disappointment at sort of discovering that Jordan College is not a thing in this world.
Yeah. I did have worries about the geography of that scene, but I'm trying not to be a pedant about it, but that's all right.
The Oxford student shows up.
Just like she should have gone left and she went right. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. Then she's in the middle of the countryside. I think they were back in Cardiff, I'll be honest. Well, did you shoot your college scenes in Oxford or was that somewhere else in Cardiff? Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah, and I had been to college in Oxford for one summer when I was in my 20s and I just loved being back there again, hanging around outside the gates of Balliol, like, please, send me back.
So, Simone, I take it you were studying quantum physics at the time.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. I was preparing for this role for all this my role. Life.
How comfortable are you with the sort of popular science of dark matter and quantum physics and all this stuff?
Not enough when people get very wordy about it. Mm. Like, I love the idea of it. And I do remember reading the books, you know, all those years ago and feeling like, wow, this is incredible. What, like, because I do, you know, believe in an energy outside of us and all these kind of things that are. But when people get very wordy with me on Twitter, I sort of go, boo, because obviously I'm not a scientist, you know, I'm playing one. but I do.
Perhaps too convincingly.
Yes.
If you're getting tweets about it.
But I do understand the concept of it, and I am absolutely on board with it. But yeah, the language around it, not so up on.
Is the dark matter the God particle that they're smashing together over in the Hadron Collider in CERN? Is that the same thing?
I don't think it's the same thing.
No?
But I also am not a quantum physicist.
and that's why this is not a useful topic on this podcast.
we should get our science expert back on to explain to us what the heck is happening.
None of us are qualified to do this. I guess before we get the meeting between you and Lyra, she meets Lord Boreal in the museum, which was a sort of a chilling moment, I thought. Doesn't recognize him, even though she'd met him before.
Yeah.
I mean, fail on her.
A lot has happened to her.
Yeah, to be fair. She's got a lot in her mind.
And she wasn't paying a lot of attention during that party anyway to any of the sort of, you know, high and hoity-toity types who were there, I guess. But it's an interesting, quite sinister scene, actually, because he knows so much more about what's going on right then than she does. He recognizes her at once, even if she doesn't. He, I think, knows about the alethiometer somehow. I'm not sure if he glimpses it from when she's using it before in the museum. But it's really just loaded and quite unpleasant, I thought. In a good way, in an effective way. But
It's setting up tension, isn't it? Like it's that we know he's a threat and she doesn't, and it makes it more threatening. And then she uses the alethiometer right in the museum to sort of figure out what next to do. I'd love if I had a device like this that just told me what I should be doing with my life. And to give such very clear, explicit instructions. It was like, go find a door with a postcard on it. This is sat-nav isn't even that good. So
in a big college, she managed to find the door pretty quick.
Yeah, it was pretty quick.
But in the books, I remember... They called him Philip, I think, if I'm right, called him Charles Latram in the books. And because we hadn't seen him, we hadn't been following Boreal's journey, and he's watching her. I thought that he was a creep, and I thought, oh God, she's in trouble here. This guy's stalking her, because it described him as like being just like really creepy.
He's a real owl fella in the book as well, isn't he?
He seems like and he's like mopping his brow and all that kind of stuff. And then, but because the TV show, we know exactly who Boreal is, and we've been following him so much that he's still a bit creepy, but we know what his intentions are, at least in the TV show.
You're right; it's a different dynamic. And he's a sir in the book, isn't he,
Sir Charles?
Charles, I mean, maybe he is here as well. He's clearly still rich in our world, and probably still important because he kind of seems like the kind of guy who wouldn't stomach not being important, you know. So. Maybe he's still a sir. Maybe that still applies. I don't know. We'll see, I guess.
We do get some glimpses into his, in the next episode, into his wealth. And it does say, it's vast. Yeah, sorry. Spoiler, dude's loaded, guys.
He's got the benefit of going from world to world and figuring out what people in each world want and getting it from the other world and bringing it to them, I think.
Oh, yeah. He's running sort of a commodity trade.
He's smuggling.
Like the Silk Road. and then we meet you, Dr. Mary Malone. Lyra gets to the door. I loved how she introduces herself. This is just classic Lyra. And what was interesting is Lyra, I think the alethiometer instructed her to tell the truth. Watching Lyra tell the truth is both a sort of baffling experience, but also
she's
just
so much
quite,
better at lying.
Yeah. It was just like, it's just madness. It was just this, like, if somebody arrived at your door, like, spouting this level of incoherent nonsense, you'd probably kick them out. But Dr. Yeah. Malone did not.
She's quite lucky she landed with someone like Mary, isn't she? Someone who's quite open to, oh, a strange girl is crying in my office. I think she's, yeah.
Must like be I say, a Tuesday.
Yeah, she's an empathetic person, so she's not going to immediately call social services, is she?
And I think, as you've said, Simone, you know, she's curious. And I think this is a very curious thing to happen. And, you know, she gets her, you know, the clincher is when Lyra demonstrates the power of the alethiometer, right? And the and which also provides very interesting backstory and sort of fleshing out the character of Mary, which is interesting. And what we learn is that she used to be a nun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just like me.
Is that right?
Yeah, I was a nun. I know.
You got me. I was like, uh-oh, didn't see that on IMDb.
I think it's probably something that she doesn't really talk about in Oxford, because she wants to be taken seriously as a scientist, doesn't necessarily want everyone to know that once she was kind of on the other side of that coin and she was more curious about spirituality. And I think when her co-worker Oliver says something to her, he makes a little jab at her about faith or something. She says, have a little faith, and he says, let's see faith out of this. It's something along those lines that she knows when she's talking to scientists that she shouldn't ever really bring up her past as a nun. So I think Lyra knowing that is unusual.
It's one of those things where there's a bit of depending on your faith, it's maybe a false dichotomy, but there is this kind of tension between religion and science. And, you know, some people combine the two and have no problems and everything's fine. Other people are very suspicious of either one or the other. And I think it's so interesting. I mean, because Mary in some ways kind of sums up the entire series in a way. She's on the sort of exact midpoint between religion and science in the same way that I think sometimes Philip Pullman is.
Yeah. I mean, when you're talking about dark matter, it is something that you can't see. You believe it's there, and you're on a mission to try and communicate with it. I mean, there is something spiritual about that, isn't there? It's not it's not terribly far from believing in a god or an angels or any of these other you know. So, I think Mary didn't come so far into science that she only believes now what she sees right in front of her. She is still on the same kind of quest, really.
Yeah,
exactly. And that's her strength as a character, is that she's able to bring the benefits that somebody of a religious background, such as faith and passion and commitment, can apply to a sort of a scientific endeavor. And that's why she's uniquely positioned to investigate dust, as we say, which kind of is a little bit of both.
Yeah.
If you're listening to this podcast, you must recognize the value of asking questions. At Aramco, our questions help us engineer a better future. How can today's resources fuel our shared tomorrow? How can we deliver energy to a world that can't stop? How can we deliver one of the fuels of the future? How can we sow curiosity to harvest ingenuity? To learn more about how innovation drives us forward, visit aramco.com/poweredbyhow.
Also, of course, at the same time that Lyra's meeting Mary, we also have Will in Oxford. So I thought this was really good because he does see his mum. He doesn't obviously go up to her, but he just wants to check she's all right, which I thought was really important to have in there. But we also have the meeting with his grandparents when he goes to the lawyer and finds out that he has grandparents in Oxford. And if I remember correctly, this is new from the book. He goes to the lawyer in the book, but I don't think he goes to his grandparents. So this is a new bit, and it's a new wrinkle, because essentially he gets betrayed again when he does. poor Will. I mean, he's kind of getting dragged through the ringer here. But it's a really, again, a really interesting scene because he's looking for a way out for him and his mom. He thinks if he has the money, then maybe that will be all he needs. And, you know, that will kind of be job done and they can get away. And it's just not going to be that simple. I guess it's a closing off of avenues of escape for him.
But yeah. What it does lead to is a very interesting, we see, I think for the first time mostly out of character for Will is this uncharacteristic lashing out of this anger when he then meets Lyra afterwards, you know, in the park, because he's scared and hurt and she's kind of gone against his better judgment. You know, they have very different approaches to things. Mm. And he massively lashes out at her, which doesn't feel very, very Will. It's certainly not the Will that we saw, how he was treating her in the last episode.
Yeah, I think he's got a lot of anger, but I think it's generally better controlled, maybe. Is, you know, like we saw with his boxing, I think, in the very first scenes he was in, wasn't it? It was one of the one of the ways he was introduced. So, like, there's a lot of kind of fury there, but generally speaking, he knows how to keep himself managed because he's had to, and he's had to look after himself. He's had to look after his mother for just, you know, years. It's a kind of a burden no kid should have to bear, but he's done it, and he is usually in control of it. But I think it's good to be reminded sometimes that there is that pain underneath, I guess.
Parenting, isn't it? Like with Lyra, she's being a little bit careless.
Yeah, good point.
And he's used to taking care of somebody who's not making great decisions. And I think it was a little bit of a reflection on sometimes he might snap at his mum if she's doing something that's, you know, putting her in danger.
That's a nice point. I hadn't considered that sort of. There is a bit of a parent-child dynamic between Will and Lyra, isn't there?
Yeah. Lyra's definitely much more reckless. lot more reckless.
Well, she's been mollycoddled her whole life in the full of adults taking care of her. And she's been sort of trying to break out and rebel against it. And he's been the complete opposite. Nobody's been taking care of him.
Yeah.
Very sad.
And so then the other big plot this episode, and I think this one is much kind of built up from the books and sort of meant to maybe remind us what these kids are up against, is the Magisterium and to some extent their kind of campaign against the witches, because we saw last episode, you know, Rudyard Scouty breaking in, killing the Cardinal, or at least wounding the Cardinal. We now see the Cardinal dead. We see the power struggle to kind of replace him, and the decision as a result to be tough on witches, tough on the causes of witches, and basically bomb the witches' homeland.
Yeah, I thought all this stuff was fascinating, really interesting. Watching this sort of power vacuum and the struggle in the Magisterium, I watched this the week of the election in the US as well, so it felt very timely. All this grandstanding and what I thought was there was a few interesting things that this sort of showed us an insight into the Magisterium was. Ultimately how it ends up with this decision to, you know, warfare as a display of power, but also this kind of how they treat Dr. Lancelius and his message from the witches with just straight into a show trial, basically. Mm. It's the sort of injustice that makes you squirm as a viewer, right? I found.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much so. I think, he's been sent as a sort of ambassador between nations, as the witches see it, and I think as he sees it. So then to be put through that, to be denounced as, you know, being born out of wedlock and sort of, you know, having aspersions cast on his mother. I mean, they're literally basically telling your mum jokes at him. Like, it couldn't be less respectful. And then to be hauled off to prison as well. Like, it's pretty horrific behavior. And it's, again, it's an interesting insight into the character of the two leaders vying for this cardinal's position, isn't it? The sort of the Sound and the Fury kind of just, both of them can unite and, you know, basically gang up on this guy because they just don't see him as having enough power to be worthy of more.
There was also lovely moments when they were describing how witches are able to separate from their demons, because obviously Mrs. Coulter can do that. We don't know how. And and then when they talk about giving your child away and there's this like slow zoom in on her discomfort, I thought that was fab.
Yeah. I wondered if that was like a deliberate attack on her as an ally of his opponent a little bit, you know, I've forgotten his name. This is really terrible. But if your man knew that she was
Father
kind of
McPhail. Oh, the other, not
the other one.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
The Joe Biden of
No one remembers the loser's name.
The loser's name. Yeah.
Oh, Trump then.
Yeah. If he was deliberately attacking her as an ally of Father McPhail, I don't know. But certainly it made her squirm and made her.
Well, even if he wasn't deliberately doing it because she was in the room, those kind of men aren't even. They don't even care if someone is in the room. Like they'll say what they want to say regardless of hurting somebody's feelings. So I don't know how deliberate it was for her, because he seems to be so focused on Dr. Lancelus that I don't know if he even cares that Mrs. Coulter was in the room that it might be relevant to her. I don't think he probably thinks much about her.
Probably not.
He was campaigning, really, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He was just going through his campaign bullet points. Which it reminded me of also another thing I watched recently was the trial of the Chicago Seven. This whole idea of like a political trial.
Yeah.
And just this Dr. Lancelius here is just he's just a tool.
Yeah.
Really to an end.
Yeah.
But yeah, with very like little time they gave us a very interesting look at the dynamic of the magisterium and these sort of how it's very familiar really in many ways to this sort of corrupt hierarchical system, which is interesting because last week, Helen, we were talking about how it's a bit of a flat structure actually, right? There's a lot of different units.
Yeah.
But
this reminds you it's not entirely flat, if you like, there are definitely massive power struggles in it. And I think it's interesting, you know, they're obviously sort of modeling themselves on the Catholic Church in terms of the election, the sort of the smoke, you know, the braziers brought in and this kind of thing. But at the same time, it's clearly also a political maneuver. It's also something with real world military consequences when things like this happen. So it just reminds us it's a theocracy and not just a religion. It's an actual system of power. And that's what makes Father McPhail's character quite interesting in this episode, or Cardinal McPhail, I guess. You know, his relationship with his demon, his relationship with doing what he feels needs to be done, or what he decides should be done, at least. So that masochism we see from him and his demon kind of egging him on. Again, it's one of these. They have some really disturbing demon scenes in this show. They had it in season one with Mrs. Coulter and her completely mute demon. And I feel like this is maybe the first big one we've seen this season.
Yeah. I was watching with my son and he said, why isn't... Does this guy's demon not talk either? And I was thinking, I haven't seen any of the magisterium demons talking. So when she did talk, there was... something lovely about it, that like that masochistic voice, put your hand over the flame, like it's nice that the demon is even more assured in the, you know, penitence and all than he is.
That's a really good point. I hadn't noticed that none of the religious types demons, I mean, and that goes to Lord Boreal even as well, who I'm not sure if he's particularly religious or if he's just power mad, but you know, again, I don't remember hearing his demon much or at all.
Yeah.
So, wow.
It kind of ties in a bit, that whole idea of what we were talking about, Mrs. Coulter and the monkey last season, was this like repression of oneself.
Yes.
You know, this complete like control over your soul and your base instincts and all this. And you're gagging them, really, you know? So, it is interesting to have the reverse of that here, where Father McPhail's or Cardinal McPhail's demon is the one, like his inner self is telling him, you need to punish yourself, right?
Because
it's, and that's what makes him and Mrs. Coulter really interesting characters. They're not just these, you know, 2D villains who are just like, attack the witches. You know, it's a decision that he doesn't really take lightly, and he feels needs some sort of, you know, personal retribution to be able to do that, you know, an eye for an eye, or, you know, he has to punish himself for taking those lives.
The purity of the soul and all that.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not quite an eye for an eye, though. It's like a little bit of scorching.
A sore hand for a scorched village.
But yes, but I did take the point. Yeah. But yeah.
And lastly, will we finish up on Mrs. Coulter? We haven't talked a lot about her in this episode, but she does... her power play is kind of complete with the now that she's got her man at the top, and she's got sort of power over MacPhail, and she demonstrates, you know, she does her checkmate moment here, where she's very much like, yeah, gotcha. Now I'm going to go off and do my own thing, basically, right?
Now that she knows where Lyra is, possibly gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because obviously at the end of last season, she didn't go through the gap, whatever, with Azrael, because she was like, our daughter is here, therefore I'm staying here. Irony, she was wrong. And so now, you know, now she is sort of proceeding to some degree, at least, after them. And it's fascinating just to watch her, having maneuvered everybody into exactly where she wants them to be, like do a complete 180 essentially, and realize she needs to be somewhere completely different and go off on a contradictory mission. The woman is formidable. She really is.
If anything, it's like, it's this weird, like everything with Mrs. Coulter, it's this weird like display of love for Lyra in a way, isn't it? Like you say, this is everything she's ever built towards, and then she just kind of just parks it to find her daughter. And as twisted as her kind of motivations and their relationship are, this is, you know, she's putting Lyra first. And has been since.
It's a weird thing. I still think that she's somewhere in between, like, a love for her daughter and finding out that there's a prophecy about her daughter and that her daughter is actually really important. I think, you know, I don't know if there wasn't a prophecy about Lyra and she was back in Oxford in some college, if Mrs. Coulter would be quite as obsessed by her.
yeah, she'd probably just check in every month.
You know, like send her a little birthday treat.
Because do you think? Sorry, go ahead.
No, it's just because Mrs. Coulter herself, a woman in that world, who knows that she's smarter than most of the people around her, and has had to work for every little bit of power she could ever have, to find out that her daughter is so important and so special, there must be something about that as well that gives her eggs her on to go, no, this is definitely what I'm doing.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think that's true. But I also think, I wonder if the goading about women who abandon their children was also part of her move to leave. If that was a little bit of the, you know, a little bit of her decision to, okay, you know, I don't want to be that guy, as it were, so I'm going to go off and prove them wrong, damn it. I wonder if that's just a little bit of the impetus as well. Maybe not.
Maybe.
Yeah. All right, well let's leave it there. So that we're gonna pick up next week on the hunt for Lyra, and Simone will be joining us again, so we'll see you in a week for episode 3.
His Darker Materials is a Stripped Media production. Our executive producers are Kobe Omanaka and Tom Wally. The episode was edited, mixed, and sound designed by Tom Wally. This episode was produced by Helen O'Hara and Dave Corkery. All our music was composed by John Dix. Our artwork was created by Sam Gilby. And the excerpt read at the top of the show was taken from the book The Subtle Knife by Philip Pullman and published by Scholastic. This episode was recorded remotely in parallel worlds. Finally, big thank you to James Carroll and the team at Northbank Talent Management.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.